Hi, this is Steve Ide, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and editor of PublicSectorInc.org. And today I'm going to speak with Dan Lilienquist on the topic of pension reform. Dan is a former state senator from Utah, probably best known as the architect of the 2010 Utah pension reform. Though nearly every state has passed some type of pension reform since 2008, the Utah reform is widely viewed by many experts as one of the most substantive. Governing magazine selected Dan as one of its public officials of the year in 2011. He also has extensive private sector experience, including a stint at Bain Consulting. Dan is the author of a new report published by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, on pension reform entitled Keeping the Promise, State Solutions for Government Pension Reform, which can be found on alec.org. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to Public Sector Inc., Dan.
My pleasure, Steve. Good to be with you.
Okay. So I want to talk a fair amount about Utah, what you accomplished there, the mechanics of the reform. And let me start off by putting the question this way. Utah is known for being a fairly fiscally disciplined state, and yet something must have triggered an alarm back in 2009 or so to enact such a radical change in the state's approach to pensions. How bad was Utah's pension problem?
Well, look, we are a fiscally conservative state, and what happened in 2009 revealed that it was not so much our not making contributions to the pension system. We had always paid the bill. The actuaries had asked us to pay from the moment of inception to, you know, even till now. But we had a market crash in 08 that 1 year's worth of market losses blew a 30% hole in our pension fund. And what that meant was that we would have to ramp into additional payments into the pension fund that for the next 25 years to pay off those losses. And that it was equivalent to around 10% of our general fund spending for 25 years to pay for 1 year's worth of market losses. And we realized, oh, wait a second, we did not realize we were bearing this much risk, and realized that markets are uncertain, and we probably needed to move to a new system going forward that that would make sure that this doesn't happen again.
And so, yeah, I just find this very striking, because what people have found with some of the worst systems is that poorly managed states tend to have poorly managed pension systems. Like, if you do a bad job with transportation funding, you're probably going to do a bad job with pension funding. And yet, if even Utah has trouble managing its defined benefit pension plan, then that seems to me to suggest that perhaps no one can.
Well, yeah, and that's the argument, is can really a taxpayer guarantee a 7-8% market return and guarantee it in statute? And that's what some of these pension plans are running into. Not only did some states, unlike Utah, choose not to fund their pensions, and they used it like their piggy bank, they're in an even worse situation than Utah, because we had been paying our full bill and still had a problem. So you're seeing states all over the country who are in far, far worse situations and have to go back and make dramatic cuts to current employees and retirees, or drastically raise taxes to try to balance things out. And Utah was not in that situation. I think folks around the country have found it surprising that Utah would act, but I think it's not surprising that Utah would act. We've always been looking down the road and trying to make sure we pay our bills, and so this was a clear opportunity for us to recognize that this system, this old way of doing things, we needed to modernize the system and get away from the taxpayer guaranteeing these huge pension plans that honestly one bad year in the market would just make them extraordinarily expensive.
Okay, so take us through some of the details. What does the new system look like compared to the old system?
So instead of saying, here's the benefit we want to provide people at retirement, and that's what most defined benefit plans do. They say, okay, for every year you work, we're going to give you 2% of your salary at when you retire. That salary is going to be calculated on your final 3 years. And so they lock in a set amount of money that they're going to pay at retirement. But then they fund that by hoping that the stock market will deliver 7-8% annual returns year over year to fund that benefit. And we thought, given how volatile the markets are, given how difficult it is to predict the future, we thought it was far better to start with the approach, what can we afford? And then what does it buy instead of what do we want to give and how much does it cost, and really not knowing what that cost was. So we started off with the premise that we wanted to find predictable employer costs in our pension system or in our retirement system for public employees. So we started with that in statute. We said, first and foremost, our existing pension plan is costing us about 23% of payroll, of every single payroll in the state, to cover those costs. So we said, going forward, we're gonna set in statute how much we're willing to pay. So we set in statute. We negotiated. It ended up being 10% for the majority of workers, for like the regular state workers, teachers, but police and fire, public safety got 12%. So it's still a generous benefit, but it was 10% of salary, 12% of salary, depending on the category of employee you were. And that was how much we committed to pay towards retirement. But then from there, we gave people a choice of what to do. They could either take that money and put it in a 401k, which would be professionally invested by the Utah retirement systems that was portable, they could take with them, that they could not borrow against. We didn't want people making the decision that they needed a boat halfway through their career more than they needed a retirement. But we also gave them, if that was one of the options, if they wanted to have another option that had more kind of pooling of risk with other employees, we gave them, which is we call it a hybrid option, where that 10%, if they want a defined benefit, that's fine. But it's going to be a reduced defined benefit, and the employee out of that 10% is required to make the full contribution. So we priced that benefit at about 7.5% of that 10%. And so employees would get a defined benefit that they're responsible for paying the full freight for out of that money that they get. And then that whatever's left over goes into a 401k. But if markets do poorly in the future, the state is only committed to put in 10%. So if contribution rates towards that defined benefit go up above 10%, it will automatically come out of the employee's paycheck to pay the difference. So what we tried to get to was a compromise position where the state has a defined contribution set in statute. How much you get, it's generous, we think it's adequate to cover retirement, and then we give people choice. If they want to pool it together with other people and create themselves some sort of pension stream, that's great with us, but the state is only paying 10%, or they can choose a 401k option. So that's how we did it, and it seems to be working well.
And just to be clear, are employees in Utah in Social Security?
Yes. Well, most of them are. We have some cities that have some employees that are not in Social Security, but those folks typically add an additional payment on top to compensate for Social Security.
And in this reform, I believe, only applied to new employees entering the system, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Under contract law in the state of Utah, and this is either contractual or guaranteed by constitutions in other states. Every state has this contract impairment issue. We could not pull people. Our courts wouldn't allow us to pull people out of existing plans and put them into this plan. So we had to make a prospective. We thought that was worth doing. It's kind of like trying to cap and clean up a chemical spill. The first thing you do is you cap the spill, and then you work overtime to clean it up. And we thought we were in a position that if we didn't create new liabilities for every new worker who walked in the door, we would be able to pay off the existing liabilities just fine. So that's what we chose to do. Other states don't have that luxury. They still need to make the move for new employees, but they are probably going to have to make changes for current employees and retirees to the extent that their own laws allow them to.
Yeah, I want to get to those more states in a worse position in just a second, but just to stick with Utah for a couple more points, what has the take-up rate been like? Which plan have you found that new workers have tended to prefer more, the hybrid plan or the pure defined contribution plan?
You know, we default into the hybrid plan just because of the history, although everybody has 1 year to make the election. But the people who sit down and make an election, it's about 50-50. 50% choose the 401k option, 50% choose the hybrid option. And honestly, we're indifferent between which one they choose because the state's liability is capped.
But, it seems like, I guess I don't fully understand the full details, but it seems like in some ways the pure defined contribution plan could be a better deal, or at least a very good deal. I mean, in the hybrid plan, the employee is still bearing some risk there, right? If you say that, you know, if the market tanks and the employer contribution would have to go up, then they bear the risk for that increased contribution, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, my preference would be to go in the 401k. It's portable. I mean, that's the other thing with the hybrid is it's not terribly portable. But that's my preference. I'm kind of a younger generation of worker, and I think over time, because defined benefits really in the private sector aren't really around, I think more and more people are going to feel comfortable choosing the 401k option. And over time, I think that will continue to grow. I mean, year one, we had a 50% uptake of the people who sat down and actually affirmatively made the election. So that's going to continue, I think. And that's just, I think, the natural movement of this of the labor market in this country. But, you know, but the real fact is that the state puts in a significant amount of money on behalf of their employees for retirement. But then the risk of that retirement is shifted entirely in both situations to the individual.
Now, let's take a more nationwide look at this pension problem, similar to what you did in your recent report. When you look around at places like Illinois and Kentucky, places which have systems which some people have said could actually turn into pay-as-you-go systems within the next 10 years or so, are they going to have to do more than Utah did? I mean, what sort of medicine do they need to be considering?
Well, look, they're in really dire shape. Just be candid. I think that those plans that are so underfunded that the legislatures have used for so long to fund other things by not making with their full actuarial contribution, that burden is going to fall on the taxpayers, and to the extent that the courts allow, is going to fall on existing employees and retirees. And that's what's going to happen. There are few options left. I mean, you're seeing some cities, for example, move into bankruptcy, and the first thing on their agenda is to try to reduce their pension liabilities because they're so huge. States don't have bankruptcy protection they can seek in the courts, but they could easily get to a point where they're a pay-as-you-go system where they have no assets left in their pension plan. And that makes it subject to the whims of day in and day out budgeting, and that's going to create a great deal of uncertainty for the people who counted on that benefit. It's an unfortunate situation, but ultimately, Steve, reality is not negotiable, and you can't violate principles of mathematics over and over and over and not expect it to catch up to you, and that's what's happened. I'm hoping that the courts will allow legislatures to make reasonable adjustments to clean up gaming that happens in a lot of these systems, to make these systems more actuarially sound, to address things like drop programs or some early retirement programs that are not actuarially priced right, that create less optimal behavior. I'm hoping on the margins that there can be some significant movement on that front, but we'll see. I mean, a lot of those things are being litigated right now. The first target a lot of these states have gone after is cost of living adjustments, and the courts have been mixed on those results. So, there's not a lot of good options left. But I think for sure every one of these states can improve their situation by moving forward. If you don't know you can meet your current liabilities, you should try to at least make sure you're not making new commitments at the same rates when you're concerned about meeting your current liabilities. So it makes a lot of sense to me, as one of the core objectives of pension reform, is to try to cap the liabilities at least going forward, and then try to figure out how to move forward paying the current liabilities best you can.
In many states, perhaps Utah included, Rhode Island certainly, it's very difficult that they could have enacted the reforms they did if the economy was going well. It was the crisis that really provoked that sense of urgency, saying, okay, we need to reassess the way we've been doing business with regard to pensions. As the stock market has come back and as the economy sort of continues to improve somewhat, do you think that we're going to see a diminished sense of urgency for pension reform over the next, say, five years or so? It's going to be difficult to get people to wake up and pay attention to these problems?
You know, perhaps. I don't think so, though. I think the markets will continue to be volatile. But most of these plans have what is called a five-year smoothing period. So when you have losses from 5 years ago, they're still coming onto the books today. And so people are starting to realize that the actuaries of these pension plans are requesting more and more money to fully fund the plans. That, in addition to that, the Government Accounting Standards Board, GASB, has come out with new rules that go into effect next year that really kind of pull the covers back on what the liabilities are. I think rating agencies are also getting into the game. You see some of that going on in Illinois saying, hey, these pension liabilities are a big deal. And if they end up in a pay-as-you-go system, which with some of these places they very well end up, it is going to limit these people's ability to meet their other debt obligations like bond payments. So you're going to see pressure from the actuaries asking for more money to fully fund the plan to the rating agencies pounding on bond ratings and rating the states who aren't addressing these issues as more risky. And then, ultimately, you're going to have the visibility for the public with GASB rules that are going to show full force what these liabilities are and put them on the books for the first time.
The last topic that I want to ask you about is the federal government's role in this. The topic of your paper is state solutions for government pension reform. But there are some people out there, such as, for example, Senator Orrin Hatch, who believe that this problem really can't be solved at the state level because if you look at the cost projections, a federal bailout down the road will simply be inevitable. And thus, the federal government needs to intervene now in some fashion to do something about this pension problem before it allows it to get worse. Have you had a chance to look at any of these federal proposals? I mean, what's your reaction to that line of thinking?
Well, first, I don't think Senator Hatch is actually proposing a bailout from the federal government.
No,
although certainly other people are. But, to the extent that Congress gets in the way of pension plans, and I think here and there they have on what flexibility they have and how to invest their money, and I think that's what Senator Hatch was trying to get to, opening up additional instruments for them to invest in, I think that's fine. But I am very concerned about the federal government coming in with a bailout. I don't think you could come in with enough money to bail these things out. I mean, the liabilities are ranged between, $700 billion to up to $4.4 trillion, depending on your calculation. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult for states like Utah and others who have paid their full bill and who are making adjustments to say that we think it's fair for our taxpayers to go and bail out Illinois or Michigan or other states that have challenges because they're hiding behind their own state constitutions that say they can't do anything. I don't think passing a state constitutional guarantee in Illinois necessarily guarantees your right to go and ask other taxpayers in other states to pay your bills. And I just don't think that's going to fly very well in Congress. So, the simple fact is states have got to figure this out for themselves. Their courts have got to give them some flexibility. Their citizens have to understand what these liabilities are and have them staring them in the face. And they've got to demand that their politicians act. And I think you're seeing that. You're seeing that all over, even blue states like Rhode Island to red states like Utah. You're seeing people realize that they've got to fix it. This is the issue of our time in state government and is not a federal. There should not be a federal role to bail out states.
No, I completely agree. And even if we're talking about federal, not necessarily a bailout, but regulations or somehow making an option available to states, I still think, as someone who likes to think of himself as a federalist, that this really should be an issue that states and their taxpayers should be capable of facing up to.
Yeah. You're going to see, Steve, the economic balkanization of the United States over these type of things. States like Utah that are well-run, that are addressing these issues up front, that are, we have a AAA bond rating because we do these type of things. We have our economies growing, we have businesses relocating to this state, and ultimately they're leading states like Illinois and others that can't get their act together. Ultimately, that's going to force legislatures in those states to act, and it's going to change when the people realize that they are taxed too much and there's got to be a change in those states. So, you know, I think that's a good thing. We have a laboratory of democracy for a reason, and the states really are those laboratories. So it should be left to the states. I think it will be left to the states, because I don't think the federal government has the financial means to make these bailouts, nor do I think there's a political will in Congress to do it.
All right. That's very clear. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to Public Sector Inc., Dan.
Hey, my pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
And again, that report is Keeping the Promise, State Solutions for Government Pension Reform, and it can be found on alec.org, A-L-E-C.org.